From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in February of 1909 when 15,000 women marched through the streets of New York City. They were calling for better wages, shorter hours, and voting rights. They called the movement International Women's Day. Well, the movement continues to this day, and it will be celebrated tomorrow in cities across the country. This year's event does come with a number of different themes. We're going to be discussing displacing citizenship, what citizenship really means. We'll talk about world events and how they're impacting women in our country and around the world. It also comes with a new element, a kind of a strike called A Day Without a Woman. It was organized by the women behind January's March on Washington, and they are calling for women to take the day off from paid work and caregiving if they can to help call attention to economic injustices. Now, some critics have said that the movement is dividing women. You might have seen a story in the Seattle Times and elsewhere. But they ask, what about people who can't afford to take the day off? Single moms, women in vulnerable communities. There's a lot to explore here when we talk about justice and injustice, International Women's Day, and citizenship and more. So let me go ahead and welcome our guests in a packed studio. Yamina Sangarasivam is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Director of the Women's Studies Program at Nazareth College, among many other distinguished titles. And Yamina, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much, Evan.
Also, a couple of students from Nazareth College are here. Nicholas Drabino is a senior, a student of anthropology. Nicholas, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And hello to Katie Marzano as well. She's a sophomore. Welcome to you, Katie.
Thank you.
And they're going to try to make sure we pass around the microphones because we still have more to introduce. Danielle Ponder is a Monroe County Assistant Public Defender and lead singer of Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People, and she will be giving a talk, Citizenship in Name Only, Realities from the Criminal Justice System, tomorrow. That's from 4 to 5:30 in the Madai Hall Formal Lounge, and that's free and open to the public. We'll make sure you got more details on that. But Danielle, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And here from the National Organization for Women in the Greater Rochester Chapter, Jacqueline Richard is president of the Greater Rochester Chapter of NOW. Welcome to you, Jacqueline.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Eve Alzenga is a member and volunteer for the Greater Rochester Chapter of the National Organization for Women and the owner of Eve Alzenga Design. Eve, welcome to you as
Thank you, Evan.
Well, Yamina, I'll start with you because we've got a lot to talk about with International Women's Day tomorrow, and Nazareth is hosting a conference. What's your goal in putting this kind of an event together, bringing in Danielle Ponder, looking at these various issues tomorrow?
So our goal is to invite our college community members, our students, and also the Greater Rochester community to join us in excavating the idea of citizenship. And we're titling the symposium, our spring symposium, in celebration of International Women's Day and Women's History Month as Displacing Citizenships. So what does that mean? So we're living through a time where the rounding up of immigrants and migrant populations of people into contemporary internment camps that we're calling detention centers. We've got a situation where we're banning Muslim people from particular countries, increasing police brutality against African Americans, along with environmental destruction and devastation of sacred lands and waters. And so we're living through also a time, consequently, of the rise of social movements such as Black Lives Matter, the Standing Rock protests and the water protectors, the Women's March on Washington, D.C. on the 20th, which is now an international movement as well, where citizens of countries around the world are standing in solidarity with us here in the United States. So in this kind of cultural and political landscape, our symposium then is asking us to think about the intersectionalities of race, class, gender, sexualities, abilities, all these and other articulations of how we shape our identity, particularly our sense of national identity and belonging, because all of these things are connected, citizenship and national identity in particular. So we would like to disrupt the usual associations that we make with citizenship by inviting a kind of paradigm shift, if you will. So we want to ask the question, how does our citizenship rest upon the background of the denial and displacement of the citizenship of those we fear as dangerous or as illegal others? And so how might we disturb or disrupt and displace our own sense of privilege and our own notion of rights that our citizenship affords? And then by creating solidarities with people that are different from our sense of cultural identity and belonging or national belonging, how might we open the doors to multiple citizenships that actually reflects the cultural practices and landscapes that allow us to see ourselves as connected, ecologically connected, globally connected, culturally, socially, politically connected as well.
All right, and you wanted to bring in Daniel Ponder and
yes.
Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People
yes.
for two separate events. And again, we'll get to that in a second, but why?
So I had the great fortune to witness your extraordinary music performance at the Jazz Festival, Daniel, this past summer. And what was especially striking is your call to action. So your call to liberation and freedom from much of the discriminatory practices that we see in our society, in our communities today. And in your work as a public defender and how you bring your work as a legal scholar and activist and musician, this is an extraordinary opportunity for our students to witness the intersectionalities of these practices of social justice when we live in a time where, like, a liberal arts education is questioned as to, well, what are you going to do with an anthropology degree? We've got our anthropology students here. What are you going to do with a sociology degree or a history?
We're going to ask them that later this hour. They're going to have to come up with an answer.
Yes. And so, and we're asked to think about professional programs which are meaningful, and yet we are inviting students to witness the kind of work that Danielle, that you're bringing to fore, where music, legal scholarship, advocacy, social justice, the practice of liberation, and the connection between our personal, our professional, and political lives are all really allow for a really vibrant and full experience of what we understand as our life's work.
Tomorrow, 4 to 5:30, Daniel Ponder is giving a talk free and open to the public at the Madai Hall Formal Lounge that's called Citizenship in Name Only, Realities from the Criminal Justice System. And then tomorrow night, starting at 8 o'clock in Linehan Chapel on the first floor of the GAC, the Golisano Academic Center at Nazareth College, it's Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People. And so, Daniel, first of all, Citizenship in Name Only, Realities from the Criminal Justice System, you have a number of stories that you've witnessed that through your work. I mean, how did you decide what you wanted to talk about specifically?
Well, Yamana, who is amazing and I love her, she told me that the topic was displacing citizenship. And I was like, what? You know, what do you want me to talk about? You want me to talk about citizenship? And my legal mind is thinking of citizenship in legal terms only. You're a citizen or not. But then I really started to think about what citizenship actually means. And because we are citizens, right, we are provided certain rights. So we have access to certain rights as citizens. And then I thought about my clients who are denied those rights often. So I think about my clients who are stopped unlawfully by officers. So we have the right to be free from unlawful search and seizures. But we know people in the inner city, that right is constantly violated. We have the right to a jury of our peers. And every jury trial I've had with an African-American client never fails. They've looked at the jury, and then they looked at me, and they said, that's the jury of my peers? They have an all-white jury. Almost all in city court, we pull from the county. So we often have all-white juries for our black defendants. So there are rights that are not being given to people of color, whether it's women or whether it's young black men. And so the question of citizenship became more, not so much about the legal status, but whether you are actually afforded the rights of a citizen. And I talked a little bit about the Dred Scott case, which I thought was a really phenomenal case. The decision is probably one of the saddest moments in American history. But in that decision, they determined that Dred Scott could not even bring a case before the Supreme Court because he was not considered a citizen. And they determined that based on the way the founding fathers treated Africans. there was, in that opinion, they essentially say there's no way they could have considered Dred Scott a citizen and treated him the way they did, enslaved them, taken their children from them. So I fast forward to today and ask ourselves, can we consider African Americans as full citizens when we have these two different worlds, where black boys are stopped for not walking on the sidewalk, which is a case I have, open container of alcohol, no bell on your bike. Can we say that they have full citizenship in this country?
All right. And it's a heavy subject, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've talked to you about these kinds of cases and these kinds of stories and the work that you do. And I want to ask you, do you think people will walk out of that discussion tomorrow? Move to action? Do you want to move people to at least understanding, knowledge? I mean, what's the path forward, you know, for people who kind of take in this message and maybe consider and start linking these things together for the first time, Daniel?
So I think awareness is my first step. I can't sit here and say that I have a plan to redo the police department. But I think that there are two separate worlds in Rochester. I actually brought this Facebook post from because I thought it was interesting. I put on my page maybe a year ago, how many of my cycling friends have a bell on their bike? My white friends responded, and I also said that this is a violation and that young black men are being stopped for this violation. My white friends are like, I don't have a bell on my bike. I've been riding bikes for 40 years. I've never had a bell on my bike. I've never been stopped. In contrast, the black mothers on my page, two black mothers said, my 16-year-old son was stopped for not riding a bell, for no bell on his bike. They took him down to police station. I didn't know where he was. Another black woman responded, same thing happened to my son. A black male responded, that happened to me. So just in that post, right? It was interesting to see the divide. So I think going to Nazareth, going into this academic community, I really want to bring the stories of what's happening on Conkey, on Avenue B, on Parcells, the relationship between the police and the community. It is not the same as the relationship between the police and the community in Pittsford or in Brighton or even on Park Avenue. And I guess my first step is to tell the story, right? That's really, I think, my purpose, whether it's in music or whether it's in court, is to tell the stories of the marginalized. And I think that's my goal, is to create an awareness.
Yeah, we just had the mayor on last hour of Rochester. I wish she could have stayed because I know she has talked a lot in the last 4 years about justice from a number of different angles. Mm-hmm. We talked about the arrests, more than 70 people arrested last summer on a July mm-hmm. night by the Rochester Police Department during a demonstration in support of Black Lives Matter. You look at Memphis, Tennessee that night, zero arrests, things like that. But the mayor said, look, sometimes we get it wrong. There were 42 white people arrested last July, and, mm-hmm. you know, 30-some people of color, so it wasn't about race, and sometimes we make it about race when we shouldn't. She's not saying the police are perfect, but do we make, you know, is there a concern that we make it about race when we shouldn't?
So the protest was an isolated incident that got a lot of national attention, so we talk about it a lot. To be honest, that is not even the greatest of my concerns.
Okay.
There is
it's
a bigger concern with the day-to-day mm-hmm. terrorizing of people of color in our inner cities by the Rochester Police Department. This is not a secret in any communities. My client, who actually testified at his probable cause hearing, and he had to testify to get out that he was actually on the sidewalk when he was approached. I mean, even if he was in the street, what white boy on Park Avenue is being stopped because he's not using the sidewalk? None. I mean, these are clear racial disparities. These are pretextual stops, which are essentially racial profiling. But if an officer can articulate a violation of the vehicle and traffic code, then he can stop that person. So that's why only young black boys in the city are stopped for jaywalking, no bell on bike, open container, not using the sidewalk. So the protest was one thing, but the issue that has to be looked at is the constant day-to-day terrorizing of young black boys and girls in the inner city by officers, this zero tolerance police approach that we know does not work, right? We create tension and distrust between the communities when we work in this way.
And finally, when it comes to International Women's Day, is there a particular angle for Women's Day? Are you going to keep kind of general?
I think that, you know, I talked to Yamina about this, and I was like, well, you know, how do I really focus this on International Women's Day? And she was very helpful to really talk about intersectionality. And the more I thought about this, the criminal justice, the issues in the criminal justice system should be at the forefront of the feminist movement. It really should get much more attention because it affects the lives of women. The women who posted on my page and said, my 16-year-old son was taken in. First of all, as people of color, we live in a very matriarchal society where many women are raising children by themselves. So when a black boy is taken into custody because he had Nobel on his bike and then maybe he had marijuana on him, that affects a black woman. So the criminal justice system, because black women are the matriarchs of our society, they're constantly affected by high incarceration rate, whether even if it's not themselves, incarceration rates of black men. And I do want to get this last thing out, Evan, something that's more directly to International Women's Day and to feminism is the criminalization of black motherhood. And I don't think this is something I've talked to you about on your show, but we often get a charge in criminal court endangering the welfare of a child. And that is often African-American women who are charged with that. And most of the time, it is because they left their child alone for an unknown period of time. So I've had a client who was dropped off, had to go to work. So her husband left the child sleeping, went to work. I had a client who was in the backyard on the phone, and the child was in the house. These women, it's not seen, the problem is not that they're bad mothers. The problem is that we don't have access to affordable childcare, right? And so poor women are often left taking care of their children by themselves and have to figure out how to go to work, how to do different things, and at the same time care for their children. So instead of seeing that as an issue, we criminalize them as bad mothers. And this is not happening in Pittsburgh. A woman in Pittsburgh does not go to the backyard and make a phone call, come back in, and the police are there to arrest her. That doesn't happen. So that's something I'll talk about at the talk as
well. Is there a cascading effect to their lives when that happens, that kind of a charge happens?
Yes. I mean, it's a criminal charge. They can face jail time. Sometimes judges issue orders of protection so they can't see their children. But, you know, I don't want to go too deep in it, but there is this belief that black mothers are inherently bad mothers. And that's a belief that is codified into this country's legacy. It's almost part of the cognitive dissonance that this country had to go through. In order to take a child away from an African woman, you had to believe that that African woman just was not a good parent or even a human being. In order for slave masters to do that, they had to develop these stereotypes in their head, right? And so that still lives on today, that an officer believes inherently you are not a good mother. We don't know if you left your child for 5 minutes. We don't know if you left your child for 2 minutes. But there is a belief that black women are inherently bad mothers and that black men are inherently criminal. And that's codified in our institutions, and it affects the way that we treat them in the criminal justice system.
Hearing Daniel Ponder, Monroe County Assistant Public Defender and lead singer of Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People, her presentation tomorrow, 4 to 5:30. That's a free and open to the public presentation at the Madai Hall Formal Lounge at Nazareth College. Citizenship in name only. And Yamina, that's probably exactly what you just heard, exactly why you wanted her to be there tomorrow.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, you know, when you're talking about the cascading effect, so if you have, our identities and our citizenship, our sense of citizenship is connected to our sense of identity and belonging to a community. So if we come from a history where black women were seen as objects to reproduce capital that black children were seen as property to be enslaved, and as sources of as breeders for increasing the wealth and capital of slave masters. So if we realize that we're coming from that history and that heritage, then we're allowed to think about where we are today and how people are who are placed with a criminalized identity are then denied a sense of citizenship and belonging. So my own studies are focusing on the intersection of terrorism and nationalism. So how we categorize a person as a terrorist, which then has, you know, deep ramifications in our contemporary life in terms of who's allowed into our country and who's not, who is seen as a suspected criminal, a suspected terrorist, and who is not. So I'm from northern Sri Lanka. My language is Tamil, and my national identity is Tamil as well. There's a long history of colonial invasions and imperialist occupation of Sri Lanka, like many countries in Asia, in the African continent, in South America, North America. So histories of colonization and imperialism then become a part of our cultural identity now. But what's happening, Evan, is that we are encouraged to divorce ourselves from history. So we are asked to forget about those significant moments in our cultural heritage that, though we weren't born and lived in that time, we still, that is our heritage. So we have we're encouraged to have a selective perception about what parts of our heritage we want to celebrate and what parts of our heritage we want to forget. So many times when I'm teaching my cultural anthropology classes and my women and gender studies introductory classes, I'll ask about 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. What does this mean to us? What does the year 1919 mean to us? What does the 19th Amendment mean to us? What does the 13th and 14th Amendment mean to us? What does 1863 mean to us? And for the most part, students are silent. We don't know. That's not a part of our history anymore. So when we're talking about migrant labor, the rounding up of illegal immigrants, we don't know about the history of the Brazero program, for example, from 1942 to 1964, where men from Mexico were brought in as part of this arrangement between the United States and Mexico to service largely agricultural work. And people were treated inhumanely. For example, they were sprayed with DDT because they were seen as dirty and infested with disease. I mean, there are images of this, right? But again, it's forgotten. It's erased from our consciousness.
Why do we do that?
This is where I'm asking us to think about how our citizenship rests against the backdrop of the erasure and the denial of the humanity and the citizenship of others. We forget about the United States' incursion into the territories of what we now know as Mexico. We forget about the annexation in 1845 of Texas and Manifest Destiny and the expansion of territories, because it was apparently the belief among white society, which still prevails in terms of the imperialist incursions that we are now a part of, which then displace people from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, for example. So, I mean, these stories are all connected. And I think the part of the reason why is that it consolidates our sense of superiority and power. And so Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a faculty in the School of Law at Columbia at UCLA, she writes about intersectionality, and she says that it's an analytic sensibility, and that it is inviting us to think about identity and its relationship to power. So on the everyday level, whether it's a police officer. And by the way, this happens in Pittsford, where students and staff who are people of color are questioned as to why are you here and who are stopped. So this is something that people of color within the Nazareth campus have experienced as well. So I think a partial answer to your question is that intersectionality of race, class, gender, national identity, and power.
I think power protects power, and sometimes subconsciously. I think sometimes people of privilege, you want to write a narrative that gives yourself as much credit for your own circumstances as possible. It's exactly what we talked about with Chuck Collins yesterday, the great-grandson of Oscar Mayer, who gave away $500,000 inheritance at the age of 26 because he didn't feel like he had earned it. And he has spent his life trying to convince people that privilege shouldn't be a dirty word, advantage shouldn't be a dirty word, because they are real, but recognizing them might mean giving something up. And I do think it's a zero-sum game. And I think it may be, it's just my own observation, is it's harder to convince people to part with power as opposed to occasionally even acquiescing to more rights for people if you feel like, well, it's not going to erode, you know, the power structure that puts us in certain places. What do you think about it?
Absolutely. And so we're talking about social power, political power, social capital, political capital. So, I'm going to come back to the example of categorizing a person as a terrorist or an entire group of people or an entire region of the world. On an everyday level, if we name Syrians or people who are migrating from Syria as potential terrorists who pose a national security threat to our country, well, then how do we think about how do we make sense of the fact that our country, along with our allies in Europe, supported President Bashar al-Assad at a time when we made the arrangement with his government that Syria would be a site of extraordinary rendition for those that we would collect from around the world? And then this becomes a part of the USA Patriot Act, that we will collect people around the world, round them up from the ages of 14 to the ages of 88, render them to sites such as a place in Syria where they will experience torture, in service of our national security, in service of protecting our citizenship. So on an everyday level, every time I invite myself and my community members or my family members to call another person a terrorist, we authorize violence to be done onto those community members, those young people who are like us, striving to reach their own goals and their destinies and their dreams, but that we don't want to see the connection between our citizenship, our desires, our longings, our dreams and ambition, and theirs.
Wow. Well, let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and continue the conversation. We're going to hear from the students what they think about what they've heard, and I sort of want to get in class with them after hearing Yamina Sangharasivam explaining her thoughts on International Women's Day. That's tomorrow. And Yamina Sangharasivam, who you're hearing there, is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Director of the Women's Study Program at Nazareth College, and has helped put together this event, the International Women's Day Conference, that will feature Daniel Ponder giving that address tomorrow, Citizenship in Name Only, Realities from the Criminal Justice System. That's at 4 o'clock at Nazareth College. It's free and open to the public. And the band, Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People, performing at 8 p.m., and the first floor of the Golisano Academic Center. We're going to talk to the students who are with us, and we'll talk to our guests from the National Organization for Women Rochester chapter as well. All of that coming up next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the Next Connections, at the conclusion of court cases, most people who are convicted find themselves without a lawyer and no money to hire one. So what if there's evidence of a miscarriage of justice? Well, that's where the University of Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project comes in. We'll tell you all about it. In our second hour, you might have heard the phrase, there's truth behind every joke, and sometimes jokes come from dark places. Witness Robin Williams, for example. We'll talk about comedy and personal struggle. Connections, I'm Evan Dawson, and Katie Marzano is a sophomore at Nazareth College who has had Yamina in class, and so you've heard these kinds of discussions, I'm sure. And Katie, for you as an anthropology major, is that right?
Yes, and education.
You're going to have to get right on the microphone. There you go. Anthropology and education. You know, we sort of half-joked earlier, you know, this question on what you do with an anthropology degree. And I think it's great, but I want to know for you, what do you think the utility is going to be?
Yeah, that's a question I get very frequently. At our school, all education majors have a double major, and I chose anthropology. And for me, anthropology is a way of thinking about things. So I use my insights that I've gained and the ways that my professors have taught me to think to view my students as individual humans. So I don't treat my students as if I'm privileging white or black or female or male or poor or wealthy students in the classroom. It's just a reality that everyone is different and everyone thinks differently. So I have been able to use anthropology to treat my students with the respect and dignity they deserve and acknowledge different learning styles and how to teach that.
I think that's very interesting because when we talk about teachers and frankly the power you have as a teacher, that's what you want to do? You're going to teach?
Yes.
You're going to teach what level?
Early elementary.
Early elementary. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure as a white guy, I could probably teach a class, and if it has a range of students from different racial backgrounds, different economic backgrounds, I may be prone to thinking that someone who's just like me is doing learning the right way or bias a certain lesson or that kind of a thing. So you feel like your anthropology background is going to help you avoid biasing the work that you're going to do in the classroom in favor of students who are maybe more similar to you. Is that right?
That's what I hope. Even yesterday, I was working in a classroom, and one of my students was just getting up and moving around the classroom with his pencil case above his head, trying to get attention. So I went over and I asked him why he was doing that. And he told me that it takes too long if he raises his hand when he needs help for a teacher to come over. So if he gets up and draws attention to himself, then a teacher will come over right away and help him with what he needs to do. But I would not have known that if I didn't think to ask him where the behavior was coming from. I could have just punished him by telling him to sit out of the activity. But once I learned where his train of thought was coming from and why he was acting the way he was acting, I am able to address the concerns and try to maybe figure out a more constructive way for the entire classroom when a student needs help like that.
As opposed to a one-size-fits-all
response
to certain behavior. Very interesting. Nicholas is a senior at Nazareth College who is a senior majoring in, tell us, it's anthropology and?
And public health.
And public health.
Yes.
Okay, so what do you want to do?
So I've spent the last few years working with Rochester's refugee community and the homeless community, particularly through the tuberculosis clinic of the Monroe County Health Department. And just to piggyback a little bit off of what Daniel Ponder said about this two worlds of Rochester. This is a report that came from the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency just the other day. A child from Pittsburgh's 14534 zip code, born today, will live up to 9 years longer than a child from Rochester's 14608 zip code. That's actually the zip code I think we're in or just across the river from us. Mm. So what anthropology allows me to do in anthropology and public health in the realm of social justice and education, it allows us to use these intersectionalities that Professor Sangrasivam talks so eloquently about. We draw from history, we draw from the current social issues, we draw from educational backgrounds, from public health, to address problems like this. And so what I come back to as well is something Daniel mentioned is access. And a lack of access for the people that we deal with. So at the tuberculosis clinic, you're in any medical facility, there's a time crunch. We don't have the resources to deal effectively with the people with the time that we should to appropriately address their problems. But anthropology allows me the patients to look at their problems and go to the root causes of those problems to maybe prevent them from coming in the next time. I started to notice not only at the tuberculosis clinic, but through stories of my grandmothers, who are one's a midwife, one's an infection control nurse, my own mother's a nurse practitioner. In the medical community, there's not an understanding of why people keep coming back. We have the ability as medical professionals to treat the symptoms of the disease or the disease itself, but we don't necessarily think of how to prevent it in the first place. So drawing on anthropology, my own work in public health, it's a way to actively engage with affirming someone's citizenship, where people are coming from, whether that's Driving Park or Dewey in Lexington, or whether that's from Burma or South Sudan. Letting them have a voice in the American system and letting them know that their citizenship, them being who they are, counts for something.
All right, let me ask Professor Sangrasivam what she thinks about the responses you just heard from two students. What do you think?
Well, I think that I'm honored and I'm privileged to work with students like Katie and Nick, from whom I'm learning a great deal. Just the other day, Nick, you invited us to join you in your work at Mary's Place, which supports families that are categorized as refugees or they're in the process of refugee resettlement experiences. We have the privilege of learning from one another, and one of the things that we speak about in anthropology, at the heart of this discipline, is the study of culture. James Clifford, who is a leading American anthropologist, had defined culture as not a set of not an object to be consumed. That is, culture is not an object to be consumed, whether it's in terms of food or travel, but rather it's a set of lived experiences that are temporal. That is, it's changing through time. It's contested, and it's emergent. It's always coming into being. So in terms of the work that Katie, you and Nick yourself are doing in the educational system and also in public health, we're seeing how children are practicing these actions of contestation in order to shape identities, to shape a sense of belonging, whether it's in a classroom or whether it's in a community center like Mary's Place, where there are educational practices, there are health service practices. And so the opportunity to learn together is one that our program affords.
All right, tomorrow is International Women's Day. That's what we're talking about. And I want to turn to our guests who are joining us from the Greater Rochester Chapter of the National Organization for Women. Jacqueline Richard and Eve Elzenga are here. And the National Organization for Women is, promoting or sponsoring, or what's the right word, Jacqueline and Eve, when it comes to a day without a woman? What's the idea behind this?
Well, I think we're supporting a woman's strike day that was brought about with the women who put together the Women's March. So it wasn't our big idea, but we decided to support and carry it forward. And it was really to make a statement that to take the day off work, if possible, from paid or unpaid labor, and to wear red in solidarity. And the goal is to highlight the economic power and significance of women in the U.S. and global economies, while calling attention to economic injustice women and gender nonconforming people continue to face. So what we want to do is we wanted to bring people together. And we have been hearing a lot of other people's ideas on the same subject. But the idea is it's still a choice whether you can take the day off or not. I read this morning that some of the schools in Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and other places, since the women have chosen to take the day off, they have closed the school. And that's a pretty big statement. Now, we don't want to leave anybody out from education. They're counting it as a day off. But to make a statement, what would it be like if 51% of the women weren't here, and what we're not getting are our rights that we're working toward?
And Jacqueline, I'm sure you've heard some of the criticism, as an example, Angie Beam is the state director of the Women's March that in Seattle, for example, drew tens of thousands of people on January 21st. And she said, what's the purpose of a strike when you can't afford a day to not work? Women who could possibly do this are in executive-type positions. Life will go on for them, and their career is more stable. So this, to her, screamed white privilege. I know you've heard that criticism. What do you say to
right.
that?
Right. Well, I understand, but everybody does have a choice. We're not saying everybody to take the day off if they want to wear red in solidarity or not shop at the big stores if they just want to support women businesses.
You can women-owned businesses?
Women-owned businesses. You can pick and choose. And talking about women-owned businesses, that's what we're focusing on tomorrow. And I think Eve wants to talk about that.
So go ahead, Eve.
I do. You know,
you got on that microphone. We'll never hear you.
This day is really, it's in the same spirit of love and liberation as the Women's March. So this is an all-inclusive event. Any woman who's able to be part of this action is invited to do so. Now, the suggestions were that you would take the day off from work if you possibly could, and that even included caregiving of children or older adults that you may care for. We know that that's unrealistic for many, many women. But women who can join in, there's no cost involved. You can wear red in solidarity, even at your place of employment. That would be a very visible symbol of letting people know that you realize that you have an impact as a woman in our community, in our society. And we know that women are grossly underpaid, that they don't receive the same sort of promotions, that they face sexual harassment, that they're not promoted. So those are some actions that people can take without actually taking the day off. But we decided in Rochester that we would make an opportunity available so that people could join together. Women and their male allies can come together in support, and we're doing two actions tomorrow. Both of them are focused in the South Wedge. The South Wedge, you know, is very much of a working class neighborhood where lots of young entrepreneurs decided that they were going to follow their dreams. Many, many women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, gay and lesbian businesses in the South Wedge. So at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, we'll gather in front of Premier Pastry on South Avenue, and we will meet with the press at that point in time, Evan.
Okay.
Also, at 3:30 in the afternoon, in front of Hedonist Artisan Chocolates. And once again, the press have been invited to meet with us. Requires no money. If you want to go in and shop at a woman-owned business, that would be great. If you don't, that's not a requirement.
Eve, when it comes to those issues that are listed as part of the efforts tomorrow, better wages, family and medical leave, paid sick leave, ending sexual harassment, particularly in the workplace, and having the economic contributions of women who work in the home count toward Social Security benefits, Do you feel any differently right now about those issues compared to how you felt probably before the election?
Absolutely. We are all at so much risk. We women now are, we feel like we're targets. I would say that it's not just women. It's people of color. It's immigrants. It is just about anybody. People of different religious faiths other than the Christian faith that people are feeling very insecure, and we can see it in the faces of everyone. The people in this room, I can see it in their faces. We feel very threatened. Our way of life, our democracy being threatened.
And Eve, I know you're someone I've met before, and you think about people from a wide range of backgrounds. You know, after the Women's March that I think we can say without question not only drew more people in Washington than probably we expected 6 weeks before the event, but drew people around the world. I mean, there were cities, European cities, there were cities all over the world that were having these events. So clearly there was a reaction to what has happened. But that also sparked a discussion about intersectionality in the women's rights movement and whether white women in particular would have shown up if Hillary Clinton had won, or if there is a recognition of privilege within, sort of that part of the movement. Is that a fair discussion, you think? Is that a necessary discussion?
Yes, I do think that's a necessary discussion. And I'm going to ask Jacqueline to weigh in on that.
Yeah, go ahead, Jacqueline.
Well, I would hope, and all I can do is say hope, that someday we all can go forward with the same issues, no matter where we're from or where our backgrounds are. So in my mind, I would hope that that many people would have turned out also. Because of what's going on and what even happened last night about the Republicans introducing the bill to repeal the ACA, and they want to deny people with women of with Medicaid coverage for preventive care at Planned Parenthood. And that was like breaking news, and it's very frightening. In fact, we put together a rally. Planned Parenthood already put together a rally for this evening at 5:30 in front of the federal building to thank Louise Slaughter, Congresswoman, for everything she's doing for us. But we still have to, every little thing is being shaken, everything we have, and we will not go back. We will not stop. We'll not stop marching or protesting or speaking because we can't paddle backwards, because what are we going to tell our children or in the future? What is this going to be about? Is this just going to be a dark period for everybody, or can we get together and make a difference? Mm-hmm. That's really what fires me up, because I can't just be quiet.
Let me ask Daniel Ponder, because you're going to be speaking tomorrow about intersectionality. You've brought it up today on this program. You know, the few days after the women's marches, when we talked about it on this program, we talked about this very question that, you know, the New York Times ran stories about this tension within the women's movement, mm-hmm. the tension that women of color feel sometimes when it comes to, are you really an ally? Are you really supporting? Why are you only getting involved now? We had two women who called this program. I should have pulled the audio. And essentially said, you know, one of them said, I'm 65 years old. I'm a white woman. I've been asleep. I admit it. But I am not asleep anymore, and my job is to listen and to be involved as much as I can going forward. Mm-hmm. It's basically saying I own that. Maybe it did take something like this, but I have to own it, and I'm here for it now. Mm. How do you feel about, you know, this?
So I saw, you know, the tension afterwards. I really think I have like a, my Facebook is such an interesting place to, because I have so many white friends, and then I have so many women of color as friends, and I just watch the two different responses, right? There's one group that like, this is the best march ever, this is great, and then there's another group that's saying, we've been telling you this stuff forever, and now all of a sudden people want to march. But I still welcome the march, because I still thought it was important. Maybe it didn't happen as soon as it should have happened, but I still think the march was important. But I will say that the feminist movement has done a terrible job of raising issues that really affect women of color. And that's why I'm talking about the criminal justice issues, or whether it's poverty or whether it's childcare. Often the feminist movement is seen as a white women's movement. So if we think about the history of the feminist movement, at some point white women were asking, they wanted to work. They wanted to leave their homes and be able to work. And black women have been working since we got here, right? So two different experiences, but often black women experiences are not seen as part of the feminist movement. They're seen as part of the black movement only, right? You have to choose, like either you're in the black movement or you're in the feminist movement. And that's why intersectionality is important. And that's why it's important to talk about the criminal justice system on International Women's Day, because it does affect black women.
Don't let me put words in your mouth, but what I seem to be hearing is these conversations are going to be hard, and they're going to have to require some introspection, but yeah. But at least that's happening. That better now than never, and yeah. Is that how you feel?
It's happening, because as black women, we are told by black men, why do you have to bring up the women issue? And we are told by white women, why do you have to bring up the race issue? We can't choose. But I do think the word intersectionality, people are saying it, it's becoming part of the lexicon. But I want to see now and other organizations start thinking about criminal justice, start thinking about these endangering the welfare of the child charges that black women are receiving. Because I think if white women were receiving these charges in the way that black women are, it would be a big part of the white feminist platform, or the mainstream feminist platform.
All right, Professor, I'll turn to you for some final thoughts here. Do you want to weigh in on the interaction you just heard here, and some final thoughts as we get ready for International Women's Day tomorrow?
Yes, absolutely. So bell hooks, feminist scholar and activist and feminist, writes a wonderful text called feminism is for everybody that I use in my introductory women and gender studies class. She defines feminism as a movement to raise consciousness and to call to action to end sexism, a movement against sexism, sexist exploitation, and oppression. She, along with other civil rights activists and scholars like James Baldwin. James Baldwin writes in his letter to his nephew in 1963 on the 100th anniversary of Emancipation Proclamation. James Baldwin writes, "To act is to be committed, and to be committed is to be in danger. In this case, the danger in the minds of most white Americans is the loss of their identity. And in this instance, I'd like us to think about our identity as connected to our citizenship, and that, in fact, perhaps it is a good thing to displace our own sense of privilege and rights that we feel should be afforded to us in service of building solidarities with those whom we have been taught to fear and to marginalize."
All right, so tomorrow, what do you want people to know about what's going on tomorrow, Professor?
So tomorrow, please join us in celebrating International Women's Day and Women's History Month at Nazareth College. We are so pleased and honored to have Danielle Ponder, Assistant Public Defender, as our keynote speaker. And at 4:30 in the Madai Dining Hall, in Madai Hall, and from 4 to 5:30. And then you'll also, Danielle, be meeting with students in earlier in the day. But 4 to 5:30, it's open to the public. And also open to the public is 8 p.m. Doors are opening at 7:30 at Linehan Chapel at the Golisano Academic Center on Nazareth College. The concert by Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People is from 8 to 9, a one-hour music set, and we'd like to invite folks to have a talkback conversation with Danielle and her wonderful artists from 9 to 9:30. Please join us.
Thank you very much for being here. Thanks for coming in. We really appreciate your time here. To your students, Katie and Nick, great meeting both of you. Good luck in your careers. Sounds like you're already applying a lot of what you're learning. And thanks very much for taking the time to join us. Danielle Ponder, great to see you as well. Thank you. See
you
soon.
Good to see you. Thank you.
And our guests from the National Organization for Women Greater Rochester Chapter, Jacqueline Richard and Eve Elzenga, thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
As well. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we will talk to you tomorrow. That's International Women's Day. Talk to you then on Connections.